Let's start back with Romans. We are in Romans chapter 12, a practical part of the book. We've been talking about the gifts. Some of those were miraculous gifts. We obviously, as we look at some of those gifts like exhortation, leadership, some of those gifts are non-miraculous. We now move down to Romans chapter 12, verses 11 and 12. Paul, as he continues to talk about living the Christian life, says, in diligence. And then he states it negatively. He says, not slothful. I want you to be fervent in spirit as you serve the Lord. I want you to rejoice in hope, Romans chapter 12 and verse 12. I want you to be patient when it comes to tribulation. And when it comes to prayer, I want you to continue steadfastly. As you look back at verse 11, Paul says, I want you to be diligent, and I do not want you to be lazy. What's frustrating when you find lazy people? Where do we find laziness? Well, maybe nobody sees any lazy people. Maybe nobody... All right, sometimes it's a lazy person at work. I mean, they may have to wait until the boss steps away, but when the supervisor is out of sight, then they go into sort of idle mode or play mode. They are lazy. Where else do you find lazy people? What about in school? You find lazy kids? You know, they don't want to, they're doing anything that they can do except study. Where else do you find laziness? All right, that's really the answer that I was almost headed down to. You can find laziness in the church. Now, if it's in the classroom, people will get upset about that. The teacher doesn't want lazy students. Do your homework and be responsible. People, as far as employers, they do not want lazy employees. But when it comes to the church, do we sort of see a different attitude sometimes? It's almost, there is an expectation that some members, Romans chapter 12, 11 and 12, what we just read, there are going to be some members who are lazy, and we just sort of accept that. Now, this goes back to one of the questions that you had posed some weeks back. You talked about congregations, wherever they might be, and you're always going to have a certain percentage of members who seem very, very difficult to motivate. Do you remember that discussion? That sort of relates to what we have here in Romans chapter 12 and verse 11. And Paul apparently had to deal with that in the first century as well, and he says, this is not what God wants you to be like. Well, that tells me that there would not be any need to say that unless there was a problem. So it was a little more difficult, obviously, to be a Christian in ancient times because of persecution compared to America right now. But this is a temptation.
Well, could the old rule of 80-20 but be followed in the church as well as any other places too?
Yeah, you would hope that it wouldn't be that high. As far as the people who are somewhat indifferent, or maybe the people who are lazy, but people are people, and they're going to, as we had that discussion with you, I think it was a helpful discussion, that there are going to be some people who make the decision as far as how much time and effort they're going to put into spiritual things, and for them, it is just not a priority. When you boil down where they put their emphasis and the lack thereof in the spiritual realm, it is in that same category or same ballpark as laziness. We all have different contributions when it comes to the church, but we do not want to ever be in that lazy category. When Paul says, notice the end of verse 11, he says what in conjunction with the Lord?
Serving
the Lord. Does it sound like you can serve the Lord? That's the command, that's the instruction, to be lazy. No, it doesn't. So if you understand that as far as what is at the end of the verse, when he talks about laziness, you can see that that simply cannot describe the person who claims to be a Christian. Then Paul also, as you look at the middle of the verse, he says something else. He talks about spirit. A lot of people that like to talk about spirit or think about spirit, but what key word does Paul associate with spirit? He says you need to be fervent in spirit. Now, number one, that is a verb, and it is, number two, a present tense verb. That is ongoing action. It's an interesting verb because it means to boil. If you were to try to break it down a little bit, it is a verb which means something like seethe. When you think about a person who is boiling, I was boiling mad, boiling angry. You know, I was just seething because I was so upset at what he said or what she did and those kinds of things. But you also have, for example, and we might not look at it this way, but would you say that love can boil? Love can be an emotion, which it looks like as you hear somebody talk about, or maybe they act like the love that they are experiencing in their life, it is just boiling over. Is that possible?
Yeah.
It is. How do you see it? How's that demonstrated or illustrated?
What?
That kind of love where somebody is just so in love, they are consumed by it.
Yeah.
All right? I want to be with the person. And I mean, it is hours and hours and hours. Ideally, they never seem to get tired of each other. 5 years after marriage, barely stand to see you. But boy, before marriage, I mean, we want to spend every possible minute together. What else? What about on the phone? Texting. Send you Facebook messages. Instagram. Send you pictures. All those kinds of things. And we understand when we think about love or we think about anger how fervent that can be. But Paul says, I want you to boil. I want you to be like a boiling pot when it comes to serving God. Now that is a powerful image, and it is one more affirmation that laziness and Christianity are in two very different realms. If you're going to serve God, you've got to be active, you know, on fire, so to speak, at least in some ways. Not, well, I think I'm going to drag into services, you know, maybe tomorrow. No. Stan?
Well, a term that we might use that I think is at least overlapping, if not the same, is we use the expression bubbling over with enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And that may apply here in a way that we could maybe understand it a little better.
Yeah, that's a very astute observation because fervent is very similar to the English idiom bubble over. So I'm not sure quite what made you think about that, but yes, you are exactly right there. When we talk about the spirit here, we're talking really about the attitude. People should be interested, enthused. They should find some joy in Christianity. It's not like, well, you know, I got to wash the dishes again. Well, that's probably not too exciting for people unless it's the first time. That gets old in a hurry, but that is never to be the way that we should look at the Christian faith or serving Christ. When you look at the verse 11 again, the end of the verse, the word serving, that is the same word that Jesus used in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24. Think about this as well for a second. Remember, Jesus said, we cannot serve how many masters? I'm holding up my fingers for the answer. We cannot serve two masters. All right? When you think about people serving money, would you say that that can be a possibility? People serve money? They boil over, not literally, but they boil over in conjunction with money. Do you think that happens?
Yeah.
All right. How do you see it? They serve money.
They'll do anything for money.
All right. There are some people who will do anything for money. I've recently seen a sign which, what was it? Hiringhunks.com? Anybody see one of those signs? I think that's right. But it was, you can look that up online, but it was advertising college guys. You know, we got some big, strong fellows here at the university campus, and if you need a hunk, you need somebody to go out there and clean out your gutters. You need somebody to mow your yard. You need somebody to rake your leaves. You need somebody to haul out the trash. Whatever that is, hireahunk.com. All right. So I'm tying that into Betty's answer. All right. What else as far as what we have here? Serving. You know, people will sometimes do anything for money. Hireahunk.com. I'll come and you just tell me what you want me to do. How else? How do people serve money? Yes. Yeah. People will ignore things. It really doesn't seem legal. Maybe it's completely illegal, but we'll just overlook that because we're so much love with the money. There have been some people who got into the drug business, and they just ignored all the bad stuff about it because they were in so much love with the money. You know, we're going to have to deceive people, and we're going to have to hurt people, and maybe we're going to have to kill people, but that's okay. Because at the end of the day, we are so much in love with money, nothing is going to stand in our way. Well, we understand that kind of thing, but Paul says have this kind of mindset when it comes to Christianity. But a lot of people simply do not. All right, the 12th verse gives us either some additional information or it's telling us how to further serve the Lord. There are two different ways to look at that. I don't know that one explanation is really preferable or one really changes the thought, but we do have three things in the verse. So an expansion, or maybe we have here some additional ways as far as more items that we can do. Number one, what is it? When it comes to hope, he says, do what with it? I want you to
rejoice
in hope. And then number two, he talks about tribulation. We'll define that in just a bit. And he says, when it comes to tribulation, be patient. And number three, he gets to hope, tribulation, and then
prayer.
And he says, when it comes to prayer, be what? Be Steadfast. Well, our hope needs to be joyful because it has the right connection, and that is a connection to Christ. Anybody ever have a hope which was dashed? Maybe something that was important to you, maybe something that you had hoped for a long time, and when your time of fruition finally came, your hope was not there. It had been destroyed. It had been shattered. Maybe somebody took it away. Maybe you found that it was based on the wrong thing, but your hope was not secure, even though perhaps you thought it was. Our hope is rooted in Christ, Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 3. Christ, we think about his authority, Matthew 28 and verse 18. He has all authority in heaven and on earth. He is the king. We are his people. We will share in his kingdom. He watches out for us day by day if we want to fully trust in him. So that hope is a great, great thing. And Paul says you take that hope and you rejoice in it. A lot of people hope in a lot of different things, but Christ is the one that a lot of people just don't seem to get. All right, then part of that hope is going to be, as far as thinking about what Paul said earlier in the book, it's going to be so great that it allows people to even boast, and not in a bad way. But that's what Paul said back in Romans chapter 5 and verse 2. One source said, and I like the quote, "When earthly prospects are dark, the Christian's rejoicing should be in the sphere of hope that the Lord will send deliverance and in all the meantime take care of his afflicted child. Help is on the way." Now, that may come today. Maybe it's going to be delayed a bit. Maybe it's going to, in some respects, be delayed until eternity. But God says the hope you have is something that you need to, the Hebrew writer talked about hope being the anchor of the soul, and that is right. Helps us in this life and sees us safely into eternity. All right, because we have that hope, what's item number two? We should be
patient.
And he says patient in tribulation. When you look at that word, which is rendered patient, literally it means to remain under. Another quote here, that is to remain under the test in a God-honoring manner, not seeking to escape it, but eager to learn the lessons it was sent to teach. That is patient. Thayer defines the word to remain, abide, not recede or flee, to persevere, to endure, to bear bravely and calmly. Maybe you've seen some TV shows or movies. You have some soldiers out there, and maybe it's a small group of men, and there is an attacking force, and the attacking force is well armed, they are well positioned, they start raining in enemy fire, and that small group of people is probably thinking what? You know, they're 500, we're 5, they've got some really big guns, they're shelling our position, they're throwing bombs at us, and what's going to happen to us?
We're
going to
die.
All right, now if you're numbered among the 5, what might you be tempted to do?
Yeah.
Well, okay, some people would surrender.
No, I mean, just
turn tail and run.
No, just give up that you're going to get rescued and wait till the end.
Allow yourself to be killed.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, so that's sort of option number one. Option two, I guess, might be throw up the white flag. And option three might be to flee. But none of those options really sound all that great. I mean, if you flee, they're probably going to catch you. And best case scenario, if you throw up the white flag, you're going to become a prisoner, and that might not be that attractive. But what happens if you decide to stay there in the foxhole? Looking now at this from a spiritual perspective, God says, look, I'm going to let some shells rain in on you for a while. I'm going to let the hail of bullets go over your head for a little while. I'm going to let them hit around you a little bit. You know, maybe you're going to get nicked in the shoulder. Maybe a finger is going to get nicked. But God says, and this is what we're talking about here, patient in tribulation. As that gunfire is raining in, as it is zeroing in on your position, what's Paul's point? Stay in the foxhole. Stay calm. Trust in God. Know that you have that hope. And don't be afraid. That hard? I mean, if you've got the bullets whizzing around the ear, that is a very, very difficult thing to do, because the natural tendency, as Marcia said, we are going to die. We are not going to make it. We don't know what the end is going to be, but it's not going to be good. White flag, run, or just let them slaughter us. It is hopeless. But that's the kind of situation, and Paul, as we're looking at the book of Acts, that's the kind of situation that Paul was often in time and time again. And I'm sure as a new Christian, as those problems started to mount, there were surely times in his early Christian life where he looked and thought, boy, I'm not going to get out of this one. I'm going to get skinned alive. Think of another one, Daniel chapter 3. Remember those three guys, fiery furnace? King, we're not going to bow down before the great image. Okay, buddy, what's going to happen to you? It's going to get really hot. And in they go. They have to admire the faith of those three guys. They said, God, we don't know if you're going to deliver us or not. Kind of like the guys in the foxhole. We don't know if we're going to live through this experience or not. But God, what are we going to do? We are going to remain faithful. If you're going to put us in this foxhole, and if you're going to let the bullets whiz by, and you're going to let bombs and the shelling and our position continue, we are going to stick it out. We are going to have complete faith in you during that tribulation. That is tough. That is, at least for me, one of the most difficult things to practice personally and try to teach people. And yet that is the message that God has for his people. Remember Romans 1, Romans 16, it ends with this point. The just shall live by what? By faith. Now when you're seeing the rockets come in, it's really easy to look at nothing but sight. I mean, you can see that every bullet has the ability to wound you or kill you. But God says, walk by faith. Trust me. It's sort of like the fellow who was walking Niagara Falls and says to somebody, hey, how about I carry you across? Well, as long as there's a net underneath. God says, I've got the net. Just trust me, Don.
In my 81 years, I don't recall any situation where I've gotten to that point or been exposed to that point that I had to say, I'm going to die. I trust you, God. I have faith in you, your promise. I can't remember having that, so I'm not testing that experience.
Well, and
yeah, we all do that.
Yeah, different people have different experiences. Some seem to go through that. I mean, I'm thinking of a missionary. If you are working, for example, in a Muslim country, you might face that almost on a daily basis as you're, trying to talk to people. Is this a government operative? I mean, you really do not know. And it does get a little nerve-wracking, for the lack of a better way to describe it. Assuming that you die before Christ returns, you will have a good chance at experiencing that. Now, I mean, if you're killed in a car crash, I mean, it's pretty much, well, I didn't expect that. And I mean, going down the road and 30 seconds later, I'm headed into eternity. But for a lot of people, if they do live a life where they do not die instantly because of something like a wreck, they do get to the point where they can begin to, in those later years, see life begin to sort of wilt away. And maybe it's a nursing home situation that keeps them in a nursing home for a year or more, or maybe several months, or at least several weeks, and they are seeing their life slip by. They know that they are not going to get out of the nursing home if they have any mental faculties left. And when people are put in that situation, if they have not been tempted in that way up to that point, at that point, it would seem to me that they do have that experience. They have that experience just for this reason. God, okay, you've seen me through all this time. Now we're coming to an experience that, aside from what, for example, Jesus has to say in Luke chapter 16, we do not have a lot of knowledge about death. I mean, we know that people head off into the Hadean realm, but, what happens when James 2, the body separates from the eternal spirit? The Bible simply says death happens at that process. Is there a feeling? Is there a sensation? Does it hurt? Exactly what takes place? And that is going to be one of the things. I mean, there are people who are absolutely terrified by death. There are people who are so terrified by death, they don't want to make out a will. Don't talk to me about death. They just continue to put that off and put that off because it is so scary for them. All right, got a couple hands here. I'll take Stan first, and then Don, we'll go back to you.
I don't think we think in these terms very often, but we're admonished to live a life that is a good example. A good Christian example, a good example of the gospel. And the Bible says, let your light so shine. But I don't know that we think very often about this calmness in tribulation. But if you can remain calm. Oftentimes, those around you will remain calm. So I think that this also addresses that.
Yeah, panic seems to generate panic. Now, that's probably not going to be true for everybody, but if you're in an elevator with 10 people and the elevator stops, the lights go out, and somebody starts screaming, "Ah, we're going to die!" Well, that really does not turn out to be too helpful as somebody tries to figure out where there's a flashlight and see if you can get somebody on the phone, the maintenance people, and get that fixed. Anybody follow a little information about the synagogue in Texas where they had the, I'm going to call them terrorists go in? Anybody see a little of that story? Oh, okay. Now, if you saw, I think this was out yesterday, one of the things that really caught my attention about that, they had a quote from the rabbi, and the guy was credited with remaining almost insanely calm. Now, you think about, you got this guy in there with a gun, and he says nobody's going to get alive, and, you know, you got the FBI out there, and, I mean, it really does not look like a good day. And this guy stayed incredibly calm. Well, he explained that. He said, that was part of my rabbinical training. Now, I'm not quite sure what they taught him in rabbi school. I think he's probably old enough that it was after the active shooter drills probably got started as far as the instruction. But, again, I tried to read between the lines a little bit, and it looked like the gist of the point was that as you work as a Jewish rabbi, you're not, especially if you're going to be in a place like the inner city, you're never going to know what's going to come up. Almost like, I guess, a police officer. When you go out on a call, if it is a robbery call, if it is an assault call, if somebody is shooting at you, if an area is on fire, it's been bombed and so forth, you need to be the person who is in control. It's kind of like the parent. If the child is having a tantrum, you can't have a meltdown and fix the situation. But if you're going to be the firefighter, nobody wants the fire chief to show up and say, "Oh, I've never seen a fire that bad. You're going to lose your house. You know, we're not going to go in there." That's just not comforting, okay? We expect that fire chief to have some measure of control and say, "Okay, we're going to have to deploy some extra firefighters. We're going to have to bring in some other units. We're going to have to pull back and let it burn down a little bit. We're going to have to hose down these other, we want somebody who can look at that in a controlled state and make some calm decisions." And the rabbi, to kind of finish out that story, he made the point. He said, inside, I was not calm. Another case, Doug White, who was up here, who landed the plane. Now, if you listen to the YouTube video, I was actually surprised because he sounds like he had a lot of control. But if you talk to him, or you see what is described a little later, maybe on the video that you watched or another one, it was when everything is finally said and done and he gets down on the ground, all of a sudden, it's just like letting the air out of an air mattress. I mean, it's just like, he was just emotionally exhausted. But he was able to keep things together well enough to land that plane. And that's what we're trying to strive for in the Christian life. Not to be like the world. Somebody, how are things? Oh, man, my dog died and my cat died and, they're going to repossess my house. And, you're talking to the person and, they are just running in 10 different directions at once. And you're thinking, wow, you really need some serious help. Now, that's not to say that we always have a great day. But again, for the Christian, faith means nothing if we don't truly use it. And that's what Paul says. And then connected with that is going to be the prayer. Then he says, you be steadfast in prayer. Why? Because when these times of tribulation come up, you have to have that communication with God, that trust in God, that he will see you through. And if you can get those basic things down, I'm not preaching to you, but if you can get those basic things down and practice those things, that will put you light years ahead of a lot of people, believe that they are really doing a good job at living the Christian life. And that's what you see in Hebrews chapter 11. They had that absolute faith in Abraham. God, are you going to send me out to this place where I don't have any family? Going to send me out to this place where I've never been? There are no Google Maps as far as what I'm going to see out there. There's some really bad people out there. I've got a really, don't worry about that stuff, God says. I have it covered. I'm going to put you in the foxhole. And you have all, we think about Sarah being grabbed by the king. Stay calm. I have it covered. But that is a very, When you're in the midst of the tribulation, that is a very, very difficult thing to do. Done.
But in connection with this, the synagogue thing, was it only the rabbi that was called to him and collected on the outside? They interviewed one of the guys who was there. And he said, we were called and collected because we had rehearsed what we had to do in a situation like this.
Yeah.
And basically, whoever threw the chair at the gunman, which allowed them to all get out the door, they had rehearsed that.
Yeah.
So, God forbid that we ever have that here. I'm not sure how we would handle it because with a number of people here, not just three people.
Well, I think we've got a lot of people here with good sense. So I would like to think that, again, you never want to really consider that possibility, but I think we've got enough people here who are thoughtful enough and calm enough that that would be dealt with in a way which would not be like somebody in an elevator screaming and everybody just goes bananas. But building on what you said a little bit, that's what we're talking about as far as a Christian life. When these times come up, they're times to practice. And we might, you know, fail for several years. Maybe the first several times we don't do well as far as that tribulation. But when you have people, you know, we've got people in here who have lost a job. You know, I can remember working at Hummer for a while to keep the family insurance intact, and the number of SUVs had gone down to where they just needed one rep. Now, you know, I can see the numbers as far as how many units they're producing per day, and once, you know, you start dropping and dropping and dropping, it doesn't take a CPA to kind of figure out, hey, some changes are probably in order. But I can still remember the day that they showed up, believe it was the owner of the company and one other guy, and said, you know, we're sorry. We don't need you no longer. So if you've ever had that kind of situation as far as somebody saying, you're done, you know, we're going to escort you out the door just like we would anybody else. That's the policy today. You've lost a job. Or you think about people who have lost a child. Or you think about people who have been in a wreck and they have lost an arm or a leg or an eye or something else. Again, there are all those feelings of just being overwhelmed. But God says, sit back. Trust me. Life may be very different. I have the ability to get you through it. That it? Okay, let's move down then to what we have in Romans 12 and verse 13. Talking about this a little bit more, leaving behind the things that we talked about, 11 and 12, he says, 13, communicating to the necessities of the saints and given to hospitality. God's people have an obligation towards fellow church members. And some of those duties, two of those duties, are listed here. First responsibility, ASV translation uses the word communicating. King James is going to have the word, I believe, distributing, and that simply means sharing. That is, once again, a verb, and it is a present tense verb. God says that there is an ongoing duty and ongoing responsibility to help fellow Christians. One source defined that as helping meet the physical needs of others. Another quote, better to have no coat at all than to have two and refuse to share one with a brother who has none. Now, I like that coat. I like that quote. That is certainly appropriate for this time of year. Paul was careful to make a little point here, and let's go back and look at something. If you've never noticed this before, I think it's helpful. Communicating to the every will and whim of the saints.
Necessity.
Ah, is there a difference between those two things?
Betcha.
Yeah, what's the difference? Somebody says, I sure like a new in-ground swimming pool, but couldn't afford it. Yeah, you know, well, okay, you can probably go down to the bank and get a loan or take up a second job or get a different job. I mean, that's your responsibility if you want the swimming pool.
That's a want.
There are some people who want luxuries. There are some other people who want some frills. Maybe they're not in the luxury category. But then are there not some people who have some needs? There are some necessities that they lack. I mean, we've seen here over the years sometimes dealing with families, not members of the church, wintertime comes, and they have children who have lacked coats, or at least appropriate coats. They have lacked boots. They have lacked mittens or gloves, and, you know, maybe some other things. Those are necessities. You find sometimes some people, young people, they don't have clothes that fit. I mean, they're still trying to squeeze into, you know, what they were trying to wear a year and a half ago, or maybe some hand-me-downs that are too big. So there are necessities. And when we see those, we should be willing. We need to be willing. We need to step up and do our best to assist those people. John talked about that as well, and he said in the book of 1 John, I believe it's 3:17, that if you're not willing to help a brother, you don't have the love of God. Anything you want to add or ask on that point before we move down a little bit more? Let's build on that for just a second. Could you have something like a computer that is a need?
Yeah, you could.
You could. I mean, it might be a person that's required for the job. Or maybe they need a particular program. And they say, okay, I've got the computer, but the program is going to cost me. We had a fellow here some years back. We had picked him up from work release. Work release said, we think that this is someone who deserves assistance. And he needed a welding helmet. Now, we are the only congregation I know that has ever bought a welding helmet, at least for somebody who was not a member. But we bought a welding helmet. Now, again, it wasn't, you know, a $500 helmet. I think it was probably less than $100, you know, maybe $75 or $80. But he wanted to work. Now, if somebody just wants to go out there and work in their shop and, hey, boy, I could sure use a second welding helmet. Well, you know, we're not going to fulfill that need. But this particular fellow was in a different category. He was trying to get his life back on track, and this was something that he needed. All right, if you're going to help people, we've talked about this at different times in some classes, and there, you know, like, sometimes it's difficult to do in a good way, but ideally, if you are helping someone, do you want to leave them with a sense that's positive? You don't want, or do you want to, if you kind of blow it, how do you, what happens? Can you give someone a gift and they feel bad? How can you do that?
Well, you know, we don't really think you need this, but here it is. We had some money left over, and we're going to use it for you.
Yeah. What does that sound like?
Pity.
Okay. People generally don't want to be pitied. And we think about the golden rule, try to treat people as who want to be treated. So pity should not be an approach that we use. What else? All right, that would be another one. When we think about free will offerings, there should be a free will giving. Sometimes people say, well, you know, we're doing this for you, but we're going to come back and see you a little later, or they do come back and see the person at a later. You remember what we did for you? No, no, we're not going to play those games. What else? Bad ways to give a gift. Don't think you really deserve it, but we're going to help you because we know you need it. There's some things that we can say which really destroy the gift. Maybe better just to say, we want to help you, and we're glad that we can do that, and here you go. There's no need to make a big ceremony about it, no need to really go on. Person needs the help. We have the ability to offer the assistance and do that. So give the gift with joy to the fullest degree that we can versus something like humiliation. All right, then after giving, what else do we have here? We've got the gift of or the ability to show
hospitality.
All right, we've got that also in the book of Hebrews. Should be Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 3. Some have entertained angels unawares. You have a similar word being used in the New Testament that actually described a guest room. If you were a Christian in the first century, why might hospitality have been a very, very important gift to use? Why show hospitality, as Paul talks about in Romans 12? Steve, we'll start with you.
Well, it wasn't like they had Motel 6 and what have you on every corner, so they... traveling on foot a lot of times, or it'd be a place to stay. So
yeah.
That was hospitality back then. That was one of the ways.
Anybody ever stay in a Motel 6 that was a little less than desirable? I think they've kind of gone up now, or maybe they're not as cheap as they once were, but a few of us have. But if you think back to that Motel 6 experience, or maybe you had some others that were not all that great, however bad that was, it was probably still pretty deluxe compared to what a lot of people had in the first century. So by our standards, we would say it was terrible, it was awful, never want to have that experience again. But if you go back and look, I mean, you can be in some places, and this is true in different parts of the world. You go into the place, I had, coming back from Fried-Hardeman one year, on the interstate, it was bad. I mean, I drove until I could barely see the end of the hood on my truck. It was that bad. And I thought, I have got to pull off. Otherwise, I'm going to end up banging something or off the road. So there was an exit. Well, thankfully, and I couldn't even see the signs to see if there was something that was available. I figured, you know, sleep in the truck, if nothing else. But there happened to be a motel off that exit in the Indianapolis area. And it was pretty cheap. I mean, it was about 70% less than everybody else. So I thought, wow, I mean, that. So get up and... you know, okay, room was on the second floor, and they had at least two locks in the door, which I thought was a little odd. And then the door seemed a little less than secure. But anyway, you know, I spent the night there, and, you know, it wasn't a terrible place to stay, and went down the next morning, and, yeah, I hear this shooting last night. And I thought, wow, you know, if it was that bad and they had a shooting in terrible weather, I'm wondering what the place is like when the weather is good. But, you know, I got in and I got out. But there are some places where you can stay where it is not good. But sometimes you just have to, you know, take what you can get. And that would have been true sometimes for Christians. But if they were able, as we've seen in Acts chapter 21, stay with somebody like Stephen, we'll give you a good place to stay, and you'll have some good fellowship, and we will provide you food, and it is a safe place to stay. It was a great, great gift. We may not see it so much in this country, but if you are overseas, the value of being able to stay with someone who can offer, maybe their, when Crookshanks were doing some mission work, you may remember the pictures that we saw as far as the gated compound, that's worth its weight in gold as far as security, because you've got probably some, maybe not only some animals, but maybe some unsavory characters out there. So in some cases, you might have saved a person's life, you might have saved them from robbery, so it was more than just giving someone a place to stay and, you know, we appreciate, you know, the chance to visit with you a little bit. It was a truly, truly great gift, and maybe, again, saved several lives. Stan?
Well, at that particular time, the church was being scattered anyway.
Yes.
And so those who had preceded them probably had a lot more opportunity than what we're thinking for to house those who were being scattered until they were... could become settled. So yeah. Several things would happen in that case, and that would be a few things that we've seen here where it says to, you know, prefer a brother or sister or to, but in general, be hospitable, take care of these people.
Yes. When you look at the word persecute in the New Testament, I think most people would say, well, that's always a bad word. And for us, that would be true. But if you look at the word, which is often translated persecute, it doesn't always have a bad sense. In other words, it describes great zeal. It describes people who are committed to something. So oftentimes, depending on the context, you know, Jesus talking about the enemies and he uses that word. Well, obviously in that particular case, that would be negative. It's not a good thing. So persecute would be the right thing or the right way to express the point. But here, when Paul uses this word given to, that is actually the same word that is elsewhere translated persecute. Now, he doesn't mean persecute your house guests. He simply means that you are doing this with diligence. You are doing this with fervor. Think back to the kind of attitude that we talked about before. I remember, I think I may have given you this illustration before, but Teresa and I, when we were in Montana, been married about a year in a service, and I knew that we were going to be transferred down south, and money was beyond tight. I mean, I was picking up pop bottles to fill the gas tank. And we moved into a quote-unquote furnished apartment for $175 a month. Roaches, yes. Slanted floor in the kitchen that you had to prop the table up, yes. I mean, it was just a disaster. It was a true hole. Didn't want anybody to come over because, again, you know, we tried to keep you know, the place cleaned up the best that we could, but, I mean, still, you know, if you're living in a shack, you know, it's still going to be a shack at the end of the day. Well, the elders had somebody come, a young man, and they thought that that young man needed to stay with a member of the congregation. Well, they thought Brad and Teresa, they'd be a fine couple. So we did everything that we could to tell those elders no. I mean, had we had the money, we would have paid for a motel bill. But again, they were very insistent, and the guy came over, stayed the night. I'm sure I've told you this illustration before. And before we got up the next morning, you know, he was gone. Not that we were bad hosts. I mean, he just saw the place and thought, man, I don't want to stay here. I mean, we gave him the best that we had, but I mean, the best that we had was not good, so to speak. So when you think about people trying to be zealous, sometimes you're just not in a position to offer hospitality, and that's unfortunate. But if you are, then do your best to do that, because it can really be meaningful, and you don't have to have a lot. But again, some people, for whatever circumstances, maybe it's a space problem, maybe they're in a place where they don't deem it safe, but that's not always the best thing. A little information here before we shut it down tonight, and then we'll pick up, Lord willing, with verses 14 and 15 next time. Mediterranean world, that was an important part of daily life as far as hospitality. It was looked at as a sacred duty. When you look at the Greeks, that was a mark of culture as far as hospitality. Hospitality with the Egyptians, they saw that as a favorable way to ensure a good existence in the next world. There were a lot of things associated with that for them. That was one. Romans, they were in the sacred duty category. And for the Hebrews, they knew that that was important. You can go to Abraham, and just the book of Genesis, and you can continue to go through and see how people who were hospitable, God looked on that favorably, and the people who were not, God did not look upon that too favorably. So we want to make sure that we are, again, thinking back to that word persecute, that we are interested in that, and that we are zealous for that, and do our very best. Stan?